Welcome back. Hope that first hour was helpful, informative, and we don't, again, ever tell people what to think or how to think. We just ask them to engage in the process. And the information is all over the table for you. It's not, we don't hide it here. We don't twist it. And it's kind of fun to watch some of the other outlets in the alt media kind of have to come along with what we pushed. It's not that it's us, it's the information. We just happen to bring it to you, and then they kind of have to follow along a few weeks later. It is kind of amusing to watch. And no credit. No, never. We have with us this hour a remarkable woman. She's a professional career nurse. She's been at it over 30 years. She works in a big New York hospital, New York City hospital, and she knows what's going on. And she is not injected, but she works around people who are virtually all injected, and most, I would guess, of her patients are also injected. And it's a pretty grim environment to work in, but she's always happy to help us understand what the truth is inside these big death centers. And that's what they really are. She once told us that when she was in nursing school, the idea was that they were going to help get people well and send them home to continue living a happy, healthy life. It doesn't work that way anymore. No more. Nurse Anne, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Jeff and Erica.
Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Good to hear
you?
Your voice. We're okay. We're okay. It's good to hear from you. Thanks for coming by again. And I sent a list of a number of things you might want to talk on or mention. So first of all, anything new since we last talked? It's been a little over a week ago. What's going on in the hospital now?
It's kind of a mixed bag of things going on. But it's interesting. I was listening to the first hour, and Erica was talking about the EMS calls that are coming in is usually a result of falls.
A lot of falls.
Yeah, and that's what we see. We the initial reason somebody's coming into the hospital is because they initially fell at home or passed out or have cardiac arrested at home. And that's what's bringing them to the hospitals. And then you start working on the patients and you start finding out what's going on. And it's just all over the map. That's the thing about it. It's that they're coming in with all kinds of problems. They're coming in with issues with, cancer type issues. They're coming in with...
Okay, cancers. Now, we were warned about cancers, that cancers were going to be showing up in places that cancers rarely showed up, and they were going to be virulent, very, very definitely more aggressive than they usually are. And I guess you're seeing that. We've already heard from you on a couple of cases about that very thing. So cancer is a big one. What about CJD? Go ahead.
The cancer we find by accident when we're working off looking for something else.
Really?
You're usually... Yeah. So, you know, you go down at home and you're passing out and they think it's a result of a fall or whatever. Well, that's not necessarily would be the first thing. You wouldn't think cancer right off the bat. It's usually you're thinking cardiac, respiratory-wise, and then you bring them in and you start working them up. You're looking at their blood, you're doing their CAT scans, and then it's there. Boom. That's when you see it, when the diagnostic starts coming back. The blood
Are you actually seeing, I mean, are you seeing tumors, or is it showing up in the blood work? Or
Where it shows is the blood work is off. Usually they're coming in either very anemic, so actually their hemoglobin levels are quite low, but the persons who have actually, when you go to do the diagnostics and you see the cancers are in the lungs and it potentially in the liver, and I had a case there last week where it had metastasized and she had not been told yet by the physicians that they found the cancer. It was literally everywhere. But they didn't know that until they did the diagnostics.
And they left it up to you to tell her?
Oh, gosh, no. I actually, as a nurse, we are not allowed to tell the patients. We may know, but we'll never be allowed to tell the patients. But and I would never want to be the person who has to deliver that message.
No. Okay. No, you've got you've got a lot of falls. You have two different types of patient. One has been injected, and the other has not. So what are we seeing? The predominant number of patients in the hospital are injected, would you say, still?
100% most of the time are vaxxed. As I said, the last time I was on a call, the last time I reviewed all of my charts, I go through it like a fine-tooth comb. And every one of them were vaxxed with the exception of one person. That was it. All of the people are vaxxed. And they're vaxxed multiple times.
And all of the staff is virtually vaxxed, too.
Correct.
You have the dying trying to save the dying.
Yeah. The only staff people you will see that are not vaxxed are coming from states of where they didn't regulate the mandates to have medical staff vaccinated. And if we see nurses coming from Florida, those nurses are not vaxxed.
Most of the Filipinos are vaxxed, though, aren't they? They're supposed to be.
Yeah, they are. They are. And we have quite a few Filipino nurses in the hospital. I'll give it to them, though. They are wonderful people to work with. They're hard workers, and they're pleasant to work with. So they really genuinely care about their patients. For the first time, I'm actually can say this out loud now in 2.5 years where in the beginning, all the staff were thrown into it and everybody was on board. But once they mandated the vaccination for the staff, you could see staff who were jovial and, you know, happy and nice to be around and great to work with. Their personality started to change. And
after they were shot.
After they had received the vaccine, And it was pretty fast. For some people, it was like, there was a young girl, she was only 23. She worked with me in the medical ICU unit, and she was shot up, and she was, it really affected her right away. And she's completely changed. She's a completely different person than what she once was.
Wow, that's really a shock. Give me an example of what was most different about her that occurred quickest. What happened? What was it?
Her personality, well, as I said, she was very jolly and jovial. She was one of the jokesters, you know, of the unit.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're still professional, but we'll go in and we'll be taking care of patients. And, the patients... we'll be have the TV on, and we would be cleaning the patients up from maybe some form of an accident or a spill, or maybe you know that they, if they're a GI bleeder, you know, they're bleeding, and we'd be cleaning them up, and they'd have the TV on, and there'd be music on, and I'd be like, oh yeah, I really love this song. This was a good band, and we'd be talking about an old band, right? And of course, she's only 23, so she wouldn't know the band, you know. And she goes, I don't know this person. Like, she goes, and then she's a joke to the patient, saying, can you put something on that I can dance to? You know, and, you know, that kind of thing. And,
sure.
It used to be really funny. Not anymore. Like, she, she doesn't kid around anymore. She just lost her. Life. She doesn't go out anymore. She used to be dating a person. They broke up, and her social life is non-existent.
Question.
It works.
Do you think she doesn't feel well, or do you think it's something psychiatric in nature that has changed her? Or is it both, perhaps? A lot of people, you're the pro, but we think that a lot of people are sick, they don't feel well, and they hide it. But it has to come out in their personality because they don't feel good. So what are you seeing? Both? Is it something changing in the mind, in the brain, as well as that they may be sick?
I would think so. I mean, I think psych-wise, I don't think she exhibits, well, she's withdrawing a lot from society, like not participating in things anymore. She's not going out anymore. That kind of thing. Okay. She's kind of with, and you see, COVID did a number on a lot of people. Those lockdowns, they brought huge amounts of depression to all generations of society. And then they had the nerve to start telling doctors now that they need to be like prescribing these antidepressants and SSRIs and things like that to patients.
Yeah.
Now, as a nurse, you can't be taking those things because you can't function, for one. It just takes you over. And so you have to kind of try and push through and deal with it. But that being said, the patients, they're on all these massive amounts of medications that are insane. And so I did actually talk to an old lady that lived in where I live, and she was taking antidepressants and hypertensive meds. And then she said during COVID, she was on lockdown all the time. She goes, she found herself drinking a bottle of wine. And I was thinking, oh, great, they combine that with your antidepressants and your hypertensive meds, and now we have a whole other host of other problems. And that's what happened. You have all these little old people and other people taking all these massive amounts of drugs that wouldn't have been necessary had they had the lockdowns and the medication and the vaccines, and depression set in. They were cut off from their families. Now, from the standpoint of the medical professional people, you can't really be taking those kind of meds because they really will affect you on your job.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a small amount of them to cope. But I mean, if you're at a level where you have to take an antidepressant to function and perform as a nurse, then you really need to be getting some help outside of the workplace. You wouldn't be able to function. So a lot of nurses pushed through, but then the push through is now you see kicked off nurses, short, you know, quip with people. There's less tolerance. A lot less empathy. But the Filipino nurses, they don't seem to exhibit those things right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's the opposite.
Well, very good. Okay, Erica, go ahead.
So she's been like this for over a year now?
She's like that, well over a year.
So it's as if it's permanent.
Once the mandates happened, I happened to be there when they initially started. Well, first of all, it was it's your choice, you can get it. And so she went ahead and she got it. Then it became a mandate. Then when they started introducing the mandates, I was out. I was like, no.
Are there any other changes that you've noticed in addition to that now?
She used to be very fit and very trim, and she's gained a lot of weight. Yeah. And she's not as energetic as she used to be. She's very chronically fatigued all the time. And she's also more susceptible now. You'll notice a lot of the times they were telling me she calls in a lot now because she's sick. They call in with the various types of infections and stuff like that.
See, that's why I asked. These people are sick. Myriad of different illnesses, and they don't want to talk about it. So they keep it to themselves. It adds to the depression. It adds to the hostility, the anxiety, the antagonism. It's a slow road, but the destination seems pretty clear. It's sad. What about the blood, Nurse Anne? What are you seeing in the blood? We want to hear about that.
Yeah. Well, I looked back on the cases when I went up to the oncology unit because they pulled me up to oncology a couple of times. From the surgical ICU and the surgical step-down unit, I will tell you right off the bat, and you probably should know this, is they do not check certain blood. They don't certainly run blood tests. Certain blood tests aren't run on that particular unit because they feel they don't have to. But they're not doing D-dimers anymore. Interesting, I would say. And then they never in the surgical ICU unit. They never run iron levels. At all, ever. I have never seen an iron level been done on any of this. Never.
Isn't that a little bit suspect? Isn't that suspicious?
Yes. Very.
They're trying to cover it up. This is not normal.
But in oncology, they do it. And the reason they do it is because the oncology patients are more susceptible to anemias and infections and stuff like that. So that's why they run the iron levels on the oncology patients.
Can you remember, Anne, what the iron levels are coming back at? Are you seeing normal iron levels? Or are you seeing anything excessive?
The ones that the patients who have been coming in and they're basically... The cancer has metastasized, and that means it's spreading all over now. It has started in one primary location, spread to other organs. Typically, they would say a safe iron level would have been like 20 milligrams per kilogram is a safe number, right? That's typically what you would look at. Now, mildly high would have been between 20 and 60. And 60 milligrams per kilogram is basically, is causing a circulatory collapse. So you're seeing in the cancer patients, they're well over 60. They're off the chains. You'll see that a lot.
Is that traditional or is that something that you've noticed in the last year or two?
Well, to be fair, I haven't been an oncology nurse, but I would have said that in those time frames, in another time, I would not have seen them numbers. I would not have seen them numbers.
So they're through the roof.
They're through the roof, which it sets them up for a lot of problems thereafter. Cancer is just one of them, but they're set up for so much more.
Oh, yes. Because we've been talking about that. Eric has been talking about iron unbound in the system can just go through like a power lawnmower, just ravage everything.
There's no way to really get rid of excess iron in the blood. They used to do in the olden days in King Henry VIII, they used to do blood bleeding.
Right.
I don't think anybody's going to go for that right now.
Well, you know what they're doing now, Anne? They're donating their blood. So they're bloodletting that way.
I was going to go there. You beat me to it.
Okay, sorry.
Donating their blood. Donating their blood will allow the blood levels, the excess iron levels to drop. And then here's an interesting one. They would have said if you were a young woman, you would be menstruating and you could actually drop your levels that way. But here's the problem. The young women are all messed up. They're either going one way, the wrong direction too much, or not at all. Their hormones are completely...
You have two dire situations. You know, you're anemic at the same time you have iron overload in the tissues.
And actually that young girl that I was talking about, she's one of them. She's not regularly menstruating anymore. She hasn't had in over a year and a half.
Wow.
How many shots?
You got two.
That's all it took.
But she, two, yeah. But she got the very first one. The first one almost took her out completely.
Jeez.
Now, for all of you who are new or don't remember, there's too much to remember. We all forget. One of the primary things the spike protein does in its retinue of horrors, tell them, Erica, what does it do to the bound up iron in the body, which is most commonly found attached to the heme? What does it do?
So one of the targets of the spike protein is the blood cell, the red blood cell, and when it attaches, it can destroy it, or perhaps the white blood cells see it as infected and destroy it. But then the iron becomes unbound and floats around, and that's problematic. And that will drive inflammation and cause the body to start to sequester what iron stores it has. So you've got a problem. You've got iron that's going to be trapped in organs and tissues, and then this is supposed to be a transient, temporary thing. But with the case of the spike protein, it becomes chronic. So your body's going to try to rebuild those red blood cells, and it's not going to be able to because the iron is trapped in the cells, and the same thing is preventing you from absorbing it from food as well. It's a protective mechanism. Mm-hmm. So it sets the stage for this anemia of chronic disease or anemia of chronic inflammation. And it's very hard to manage that. I mean, usually you would give somebody red blood cells to replace the ones that are lost and can't be rebuilt. But now you're also adding more iron
to
the system.
That's a vicious cycle. Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
It's a vicious cycle. Yeah. And I agree with you, Eric. Everything you're saying is spot on. It's just that's exactly what happens. The excess iron in the internal organs accumulates to the point where it damages, you pick an organ at this point. It damages the brain, it damages the liver, it sets you up for cancers. If you're a diabetic, it just totally throws off all your levels there. It could potentially send you into heart failure. And the other biggie is it affects the immune system, which basically it can kill some bacteria, but excess in amounts of iron stimulate the growth of bacteria and viruses. Very convenient in the world we're living in right now.
Right. No, it's a disastrous situation. I don't really see anybody addressing it. You know, we talk about the endothelium. You know, the endothelium's being destroyed too, and that's another source of clotting, cause of clotting. But no one's talking about the blood itself and this issue with the iron regulation.
Are we seeing black blood still the same as before?
Yes, and actually that was another thing I wanted to talk to you about with the black blood. I mean, because I wasn't thinking about the iron at the time when I was drawing the blood. I was always thinking about the black blood as, you know, the clotting issue and how it was working on their clotting factors and things like that. But your blood becomes even darker if you have excess iron, and the proof is in the pudding is when you have a patient that is, you used to put patients who have low iron levels, that's not, and it gives them iron, supplemental iron to take. And then when they would pass their stools would be black, and it would be directly related to the iron. It would cause the stools to go black. And they would tell patients, don't be alarmed when you see that, because that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't put the iron piece of it together until actually just now, when we were talking about it. But if you have excess iron in the blood, chances are that's what's causing the discoloration of the blood too. I never thought
about
it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's oxidizing the hemoglobin or heme. And so you've got an issue with, you know, too much oxidation. You can't recycle the oxygen there. So, yeah, the blood is getting destroyed, absolutely destroyed.
So the blackness in the blood is lack of oxygen and potentially an accumulation of iron.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm thinking now, because I didn't put it together, but now that I think about how it affects the GI tract when they give the supplemental iron to the patients, they end up stooling black stool. Mm-hmm. And it is. It's jet black stool. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And they say, that's what they tell them. Don't be alarmed. That will happen. And then if you have any kind of a GI bleed, well, for one, you'll smell it because it's rank. But if somebody was to have a GI bleed and it goes and you're pooping out stool, you'll have black stool and potentially bloody stool.
Right.
All right. So of all the patients who come into the hospital you're working at, just for the heck of it, how many of them get better and go home healthy?
Well, they don't come in healthy, Jeff, at this point.
Understood.
So are they going home?
Are you able to bring them back to good health and discharge them like in the old days? Not too often, it doesn't sound like.
I would say the patients on the oncology units, they don't have much time between the initial diagnosis and the time of being told that they get the vaccine and then the initial diagnosis to the time of getting to treatment is just a matter of weeks. So those poor people have no time. And I talked about a case a few weeks back about the guy who was diagnosed on 9/11. The vaccine on 9/11, by 9/21, he was given a diagnosis of cancer. And that's how quick that happened for him. And now they were talking about treatment. So, that's that group of people. Now, the people who are that don't have cancers, they have a whole other host of other issues. So, are they going home healthy? No, they're not going home healthy. They're going home at baseline what they came in with, if they're lucky.
Got it. All right. What about psychiatric? I know you don't work in the psychiatric wing, but I'm asking about CJD, prions in the brain, other brain disabilities that are being caused by microclotting and death of brain cells, et cetera. Are you hearing anything about that? Are you running across patients who present with psychiatric problems as well as some physiology issues?
Yeah, I would say how it's presented to us is the families will come in and they'll say, they never used to act like this. And that's usually your red flag right there. And I mean, I'm telling you, it's playing havoc with the old people. The old people who would be, quiet and polite and nice their system is so hammered at this point that when they get to the hospital, they're facing, in the ICU, we always had this to contend with, was delirium because they're in the hospital for so long and they don't know, they're getting drugged up. And so there's delirium is one thing. But the ones that come out of the ICU and then are in the step-down unit or the med-surg unit, they're acting out and with behavioral situations, like they're lashing out at the staff, or they're just cursing and swearing like they never did before. Like they could have been a perfectly good church-going person, and now they're using profanity that you wouldn't hear, from the corner kid, it's crazy. And then you'll see you'll have like security people coming up trying to control people that are all of 4 foot tall, you know. And you'll have these big security guys coming over. And,
well,
and
you told us the one story.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 150-year-old woman was fighting off 10 men. Wasn't that it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's incredible. And she had super strength. She had super strength. And it's insane. I mean, they just start acting out like you cannot believe. So the behaviors are coming out. Is it related to the prions? I have no way of knowing that for sure, mm-hmm. but I just mm-hmm. know that the families, when they come in, they're devastated because now their loved one, either they find the person in restraints because you can't take care of them unless they're restrained.
Well, they've lost their family member. Their family member has been taken away from them, stolen from them, as it were, or destroyed. Here's a new story from Dr. Joseph Mercola, who reports that 100% of mRNA jab recipients have heart implications now. 100%. Shocking new study reveals that some level of heart injury, minor as it may be, is occurring in all so-called vaccine recipients. The long-term effects are unknown, but there will be effects. The more mRNA shots you take, the greater the cumulative risk that an actual health event will take place. There are also effects on other internal organs as well as the entire immune system. Because authorities and mRNA manufacturers refuse to stop the mRNA shots, they can only be viewed as biological warfare against humanity. Well, thank you, Joseph Mercola's editor. These are biological weapons. We've been saying it for way over a year now. They have nothing to do with vaccinating anyone to protect them in any way against anything. It's a Department of Defense-owned weapons system. It was built and designed by Moderna and Pfizer, etc., and it is working exactly the way they wanted it to. That's our best summation.
Yeah, I would agree. I will honestly tell you, there's a lot of cardiac issues. Their hearts are compromised. They're having multiple procedures for this. Sometimes the same problem, like a day or two afterwards, they're back at the hospital or after discharge or otherwise a week afterwards. Mm-hmm. And the number one issue there is the clotting. That's the number one issue that's bringing. They're coming in with lethal arrhythmias. They're coming in. I told you about that person that was coded at home, and he was in PEA, and that's pulseless electrical activity. That's a lethal rhythm, and you can die from that if it's not treated right away. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know if you could consider him living now, because he ended up with an anoxic brain injury in the end, but the problem is that you'll see atrial fibrillation, you'll see people who will end up getting mitral valve replacements because their mitral valve fails, or their pacemaker, they'll have to get pacemakers, or they'll end up coming in and be put on anticoagulant therapy for the rest of their lives. And it's endless. And then the clotting still, this is the kicker. There was a time you would actually go, okay, you're on Coumadin for the rest of your life, or you're on Eliquis for the rest of your life, which are two blood thinners that are used for patients that continue to live at home. If those drugs were working, you shouldn't be clotting. And that was one of the things I was seeing I was in another part of New York where they were coming in and they were clotting and they were stroking out.
We know now these are not blood clots. They're amyloid clots, and the blood thinners will have no effect on them at all, none. Listen to this, another note. And this, I've always felt this way, but it's the first time I've seen it in print. This is from the Dr. Mercola article. Long COVID refers to symptoms that persist for 4 or more weeks after an initial COVID-19 infection. Second sentence, most importantly, many are also reporting long COVID symptoms after simply getting the shot. I think a lot of these long COVID cases are long bioweapon injection cases. And he goes on to say, symptoms of long COVID include, but are not limited to, symptoms of long COVID, brain fog, memory problems, headaches, blurred vision, loss of smell, nerve pain, heart rate fluctuations, dramatic blood pressure swings, and muscle weakness. The feeling of internal electric shocks are also reported. So this biological weapon owned by the Department of Defense is doing exactly what it was supposed to do. But my God, is it diverse in its ability to cause life to come to an end.
Yeah.
And I think we may have lost Anne. You there, Anne? Ah, we lost her. I heard the little beep beep, and we'll get her back. But this is the long COVID. I'll bet you in at least half the cases is long bioweapon.
Well, there's a lot of similarities. You know, the virus for some people is a real problem. And the long COVID, yes. There's probably 6 or 7 reasons why they think some people have trouble getting over it. And part of it is just this persistence of the viral proteins, the spike being the worst. But some of the other proteins are also problematic. But we know the spike can cross the blood-brain barrier, and if it ends up in the brain and the hypothalamus or the brainstem, you know, you're going to have issues.
Well, they're having them.
But, you know, sure. the injections ensure that you will have a steady supply, steady production of the spike protein that you know, they can be in any organ, wherever that lipid nanoparticle happened to go, could be transfected and now producing spike protein. And then you'll also have the problem of provoking the immune system to attack that organ or tissue.
Right.
So in many ways, I would say in all ways, the injection is infinitely worse than the virus. Infinitely worse.
Oh. Okay. Anne, if you're listening, try to hang up your phone or clear it. We're getting your voicemail when we call you back. So somehow we need to clear the line and go back to no phone call, and we can get back to you. Okay. Well, what we heard from her is more of the same and worse. It's just people are not getting well. They're not getting better. And this issue of, what was it Naomi Wolf said? We played that video. That people just seem, the vaxxed, don't seem to have any heart anymore.
Oh, that was in this new video. I haven't looked at that yet.
I saw it in another one. She said
okay.
That. They don't have any, seemingly they don't have any heart and soul anymore.
Well, they've been literally, I would call it rape on a genetic level.
Good call. I agree. Okay, I think we have Anne back. You there, Anne?
Hello, yes, I am. I just disappeared for a little
bit.
No,
they do that. they make Erica vanish, and I have to go looking for her. And it took me 2 weeks to find her once. Anyway, you're back. Okay. We have so many ways that this bioweapon is functioning to take life apart. And I don't know how you see it, but if I were in your position, I imagine I would look at it as rather a deluge. There's so many different areas that are damaged, that are interrelated with other areas in the body. When one goes, the other goes. I mean, this thing is, as Dr. Chetty said, the most evil, diabolical thing that mankind has ever created. And we created it. Well, I still think we may have had some off-planet help because it is so damn sophisticated. But yes, I know we have a lot of talented people. And yes, we've done a lot of work with biology, let's call it, over the last decades. So I don't know. But it is really malicious. Okay.
I would agree. And the one thing that really gets to me more than anything is that I don't work in this unit because you need to be trained in this unit. But last week we had a number of code calls overhead, and they all came from either the NICU or OB. And there was in OB they paged for anesthesiology to come. So they needed to obviously intubate somebody. And it was, come to find out, it was a mother who had given birth to twins, and the baby had coded, and they were intubating the baby, and the one twin didn't make it. So that's what killed me more than when I hear those calls. You're just, your hair, you go cold, your blood runs cold when you hear those calls.
That's tough. That's very tough.
Are you seeing, Anne, and we discussed this a little bit earlier tonight, people who are, that you know that you work with, like that young 23-year-old you mentioned, that are acting and looking older? Do you see physical aging in them, some of them? Yeah. There was a report that a lot of them are getting gray hair now, extremely prematurely.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, yeah, in their facial features, and yeah, I would say they're aging quicker than what you would have normally seen, for sure. The gray hair thing, you could relate it to stress. The job has become very stressful.
Yes,
you know?
Oh, yeah.
Part of me says the aging part of it for the medical profession, I would go on to say that they're pulling some very long hours, some of those nurses. They're working 48 to 60 hours a week. I did last year I was doing 48 hours a week, 12-hour shifts overnight. And it does get to you. It gets to you. And if that's one recipe for making you feel old and looking old real fast.
Well, that'll do it in and of itself.
That'll do it too.
We are getting,
but the combination
reports,
of that, it can accelerate. Yeah, it could accelerate the issues.
I believe that. Okay, another question. What about the lab in the hospital? Are you hearing anything from the lab technicians about the blood, the clotting, the issues there?
Well, there's a lot of bone of contention with the labs because it's been an ongoing issue with the labs, because once we had identified that the blood was really difficult to draw from a regular vein, the lab would call up and basically say, you're going to have to redo it again. Well, first of all, they know that it's clotting, and redoing it isn't going to really make much difference. And now you're putting the person through this whole ordeal again. They might have been poked four or five different times to get that one vial of blood, but might I add. So the patients are getting irate, and rightfully so. So what's happening now is if they're having a lengthy hospital stay, they're going to end up getting some form of a line in there. They're going to get either a PICC line in or a internal jugular line in or central venous catheter line in. They're getting something because the only way to get their blood is through a line. And even then, the lines are clotting up.
Wow. Mm. And you're seeing this. You're actually putting those lines in some cases.
Yeah, we would assist the physicians with the central venous lines. And if they put in arterial line in the vein, they'll
Now this is a plastic line or a rubberized plastic line.
It's a plastic line that goes in. It'll either, there's a couple of ways that it'll go in. It'll go in the subclavian vein, and it's brought in into the heart, near close to the subclavian. And that would be like the pig. The IJ would go in the jugular off the neck, which is an awkward spot for a patient. You can imagine trying to sleep with that, right? Then you have the wrist ones where they'll put in an arterial line. And they're great, except for when the patient pulls them out, you've got a total mess on your hands if they get access to those because it's in an artery.
Mm.
So they're jerking them out, some of them? Oh.
So the patients are delirious and confused, combative.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And
is the
you
blood
said
coming
one other
out
thing.
Of the artery any
yeah.
any better? I mean, I would think it's a little more red.
It's a little bit more red, and it's coming out a little bit faster. And it's the one time when you don't want it to do that.
Right.
But, you know, because you're on full panic mode. I mean, it looks like a massacre happens in the room when those lines come out.
Sure.
You know, and it's you're just like holding pressure on that
but
access.
And this is important. You also said that the lines themselves are becoming clotted.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
How the hell does that happen? This whatever the blood is when it comes out of the body, is it contact with? I don't know what it would be. How could that be? What is causing it to clot in the plastic line? I know you've said that before, but it's always been a mystery.
The lines are very narrow. The lines are very narrow. So you've got a catheter that's going into that subclavian, and it's pretty big. But the connector to that is the lines are very thin and narrow. So if you're drawing blood off that on a daily, sometimes every couple of hours.
Jeez.
And over time, the blood is still building up, and you need to be flushing those lines like crazy. But even
got it.
At
so
that,
it's leftover material which is beginning to build up, possibly
it's
fibrils. Erica,
yes,
fibrils.
I would say so. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, we've got to we have to say goodnight, Anne. Anything you want to add that is on the tip of your tongue? We've got just a minute or so.
No, the only other thing I was going to say in regards to the EMS calls, you might be seeing, they might be going down because of seizures as well. We're seeing seizures, a lot of seizure issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the only thing I forgot to mention that. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Anne, thank you so much again for being here. Thanks for all you do to help human beings in grave distress. It's a very tough job, and you're a hero, and we appreciate you.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, guys, and I appreciate the time and talking to you, and we're in the trenches.
Yeah.
Still in the trenches.
Talk soon.
Thank you.
Okay, Anne.
Okay,
right.
Take care, Anne. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, they don't make them like that very often.
No. No, I any patient that is lucky enough to have her as a nurse is doing pretty well.
Yes. Yep. Well, the more things change, the worse they get, and the more they stay the same. Everything's intensifying. It's just cascading. It's like a snowball, and that's where we're headed. There's just nothing to indicate a reversal or a de-escalation at all. None of it.
No, I am hearing on some of these calls, I don't listen to it all day long, but, you know, I just happened to be present when some of these came in, and there are a number of calls, maybe three a week so far that I've noticed, of people dying at home. You know, nobody's there. It's an unintended death, so it becomes a police matter. But then I don't know how common
that
would be.
How are they being found? No one saw anything for two, 3 days?
Well, somebody's probably thinking their neighbor isn't answering the phone. Could somebody go and check? Or, you know, there's no answer at the door. Mm-hmm. And the EMT show up, and there's a dead body. So because it's an unintended death, it becomes a police matter. Right. That's my understanding.
Right. Right. Died at home. Died suddenly. Died unexpectedly. etc., died.
Mm.
And these things do not make the news as being caused by the bioweapon. Forget about it. You're not hearing any of that. None of those deaths are the deaths at the hospitals. They're not going to point to the cause.
No.
So understand that this is all being covered up and kept quiet. And they're able to do it with ease. No problem at all. None.
Well, and there's been such a lag time between when the people got the shots and what they're experiencing now. It may be six months, 9 months, a year. And so they're not relating it.
He had the shot a year ago. What are you talking about?
Right.
Anything about the new bivalent booster that you can pop in here really quick?
No, I think we're on to the RSV thing now. There was some emergency declared now?
We'll cover that Wednesday.
They're racing to get the RSV vax approved, which I believe is going to be mRNA.
mRNA. That's it. All right, we'll cover that, among other things, on Wednesday. Thank you, my friend, and we will talk soon. And,
okay, my pleasure, Jeff.
Okay.
All right, take care. Good night, everyone.
And we'll be right back with Mitchell Henderson in just a few minutes. Hold on.